Aspen Institute Homeland Security Group. I'm a former Deputy National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism. I remember my title. I'm also the Senior National Security Analyst for NBC News and the Chairman of the Financial Integrity Network. I'm delighted to introduce this next session. Deal is a Deal? It's an interesting title. It's a timely and important discussion about the Iran nuclear deal, with the U.S. just certifying Iran's compliance with the deal, while also demonstrating that it's not pleased with Iranian behavior, arguing that Iran has not met the spirit of the deal. Is the deal a force for stability in the region, a cornerstone for the future of the region? Does it slow nuclear weapon capabilities for the Iranian regime? Or does it embolden and enrich the regime, providing a patient pathway to a nuclear weapons capability? That's what this panel is here to discuss. What is the future of the Iran nuclear deal? What a great panel we have, and what a great moderator. Moderating this panel is Elise Labbitt, the global affairs correspondent for CNN. As you know, Elise covers U.S. foreign policy and international affairs. She's based in Washington, D.C., but knows the international community well. She's reported from over 85 countries. She's interviewed and traveled with six secretaries of state. With that, Elise, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Juan. I, unfortunately, it would be seven, but we all know that Secretary Tillerson isn't really taking that much press, so I hope to be able to travel with him in the future. Thank you very much to the Aspen Institute, and thank you all for being here this morning. We have a great panel to talk about the Iran deal. We're not really going to litigate the deal. We're going to start at the beginning and do a scene setter of what the deal is, but we are where we are. And so I think what we want to do is we've all discussed, and we want to use this opportunity to move forward from where we are and see where things go from here. We have Tony Blinken, former Deputy Secretary of State under Secretary Kerry and President Obama. Joe Cirencione, one of the real big brains on nuclear issues, particularly on Iran, of the president of the Plowshares Fund. Corey Shackey, a research fellow at Stanford University, the Hoover Institution, and Alex Vitanka, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. So let's kick it off. Joe, why don't you just set the scene for us kind of quickly? What did this deal do?
Sure. The problem starts with Iran's desire to have centrifuges to enrich uranium. These are the water heater size machines that can enrich uranium to low levels for fuel rods. That's all Iran said they wanted to do. The problem is the very same machines, the very same facilities can enrich uranium to high levels for bombs. So do you trust Iran? Clearly, we did not. So we wanted to stop Iran from building these machines. When George W. Bush took office, there were a couple of dozen machines operating in Iran. By the time the Europeans started negotiating and we refused to join those negotiations, there were a couple of hundred. By the time George W. Bush left office, there were 6,000. By the time we started negotiating with them, there was about 19,000 centrifuges. So what this tells you is that all the pressure, all the sanctions, all the threats during those years didn't do anything to stop Iran from building these centrifuges. The program grew. What did stop Iran? Negotiations. And this is a deal that has now withstood 2 years of testing. It is endorsed by all our allies. The U.S., well, I should say the White House is virtually alone in calling this a terrible deal, a lousy deal that should be scrapped. We have opponents of the deal who were against the deal, the Saudis, the Israelis, now in favor of it. Why are they in favor of it? Because the deal worked. Iran scrapped two-thirds of its centrifuges. They only have about 5,000 operating. It shipped out of the country all 98% of its stockpile of uranium gas, and it took the plutonium production reactor apart, took the core out, drilled it full of holes, filled it full of cement, so no plutonium path to a bomb. In other words, you took a capability that was could be within weeks of building a bomb, and you stretched it out to be a year required to build a bomb if they decided to, and then you put it in an iron cage with a camera on it, the most intrusive inspection regime, ever negotiated. We stopped Iran from building a bomb, and we stopped another unnecessary war in the Middle East. That's what the deal did.
Okay, so we have this deal. I'm going to do something a little bit different. Corey, you were a critic of the deal. Instead of telling me what's wrong with this deal, I want you to say, what do you see as some of the good things of this deal that moving forward are working and could be used to move forward?
So first, Joe is quite right that the inspection provisions of known Iranian facilities are extraordinarily good. I'm more skeptical, I think, than Joe may be, that there are things we don't know about what's going on in Iran. But unquestionably, the inspection regime helps us gather information. It helps us understand what's happening. It's a terrific part of the deal. The second thing that the deal has done well is, I think, one of my big fears about the deal going into effect was that it would create a cascade of proliferation, that the Saudis who had bankrolled the Pakistani nuclear program would find a way to get a bomb of their own, that Turkey and Egypt and other regional countries. And I at least don't see that happening so far. And so I think one of the fears that many of us had about the agreement has not come to pass. The third thing that I think is good, as Joe mentioned, is that regional opponents of the deal are now advocating the administration stay with it. That, in my judgment, is not a function of the deal itself, but is a function of the fact that the Trump administration is doing what the Obama administration ought to have done, which is push back on Iranian bad behavior in
right,
the non-nuclear elements.
Right.
So those three things, I think, are all advantageous.
And just to be clear, we're in 2 years into the deal. Some of the provisions of the deal expire in 10 years, others in 15 years. Okay, Tony, obviously a big supporter of the deal, worked very hard to implement it. Why don't you talk to us about the flaws of the deal and give us a sense of what you thought needed to be in there that you couldn't get in there in order to get the deal?
Sure, and in the spirit of Corey, I think, who did a wonderful job acknowledging the benefits of the deal, sure, by definition, any agreement is not going to get you 100% satisfaction. And we had long discussions, debates, about how long could we make this deal hold for. There are different provisions in the deal that place constraints on Iran for a certain period of time. They sunset over 10, 15, 20, 25 years. Some are permanent, but many of them sunset. In an ideal world, sure, it would have been great to get even longer constraints on Iran to buy us even more time. But at some point, you have to figure out what the art of the possible is. And just to recall, in the early 2000s, there was an initial attempt to engage Iran, as Joe said, with the Europeans. And at that point, they had 150 centrifuges.
Yeah.
And we held out for zero. And there was no deal. Now, of course, fast forward, by the time we took office with Obama, they were racing toward 19,000 centrifuges. Similarly, in 2008, there was another effort to engage the Iranians. And again, we tried to hold out for zero enrichment. No deal. And, of course, we are where we are. So the challenge in all of these things is figuring out what is the right balance. How can you get to yes? Now, the other thing I'd say is that the deal didn't cover Iran's nefarious activities across the board. Destabilizing activities, support for terrorism, its human rights situation. Nor did it cover the missile program directly. And in all of those areas, again, in an ideal world, it would have been great to be able to do something. But we were negotiating this deal not alone, not directly with Iran, but with other countries. And we had to find a place that everyone agreed on. And the one thing everyone agreed on as an objective for this agreement was to get to a place where we had constrained and rolled back Iran's nuclear program. There was no agreement about using the leverage we'd acquired over Iran to push back on its other activities. So in a perfect world, we would have, could have done more. In the real world, I believe we got a very good deal.
Alex, there was a divide within the Iranian, I'll say regime in quotes, because we know it has various elements.
Right.
Talk to us about the various constituencies in Iran and how they approached the deal. Obviously, the moderates with Rouhani, many in the public supported it, while the hardliners we're not so
right.
happy
Thank
about.
You. I mean, we have to remember that the decision to make a deal was reached by Ayatollah Khamenei as early as 2009-10. And President Rouhani comes on the scene in 2013. So in other words, the fundamental decision to have a deal has been made way before Rouhani comes in. Mm. And I can argue from my perspective that the election of Hassan Rouhani, the fact that he was allowed to run and win, was sort of by Khamenei turning the page and giving a new face to the world after those 8 horrendous years of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But let me quickly turn to today. There's a lot of smoke in Iran if you look at the Iranian media. You know, this is a horrible deal. We're not getting the benefits from the sanctions, all the rest of it. I think it's only smoke. I think what the hardliners in Iran want to do is to have the stick, and they look for the biggest stick they can find to hit Hassan Rouhani on the head with, because he just happened to win re-election on 19th of May with 24 million votes. So they're fearful of what Rouhani wants to do with that 24 million vote mandate. They're looking for sticks to hit him on the head with. So they talk about the lack of benefits from the deal. They're saying, where are the foreign investors? They've been being very disingenuous when they say that, because a lot of the lack in investment coming from outside has nothing to do with the nuclear deal, but with other conditions that are happen to exist in Iran. In other words, Khamenei made the decision to have a deal. He's still with the deal. The Supreme Leader of Iran, who just turned 78 this month, is still a proponent of this deal. So I would urge people who listen to the debate in Iran and worried about the Iranians walking away, because Foreign Minister Javad Zarif again kind of hinted at it on this trip. We're going to walk away. There's no way
they're poisoning that the Trump administration is poisoning the well, so to speak, because it won't pull out, but it's making it impossible for Iran to benefit.
Right. You know, we can debate that. I'm sure we will. But the fact is, there is a cutthroat sort of a process, political process going on in Iran right now, which is little, frankly, to do with the nuclear issue, which is about who's going to come after this present Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. And the nuclear issue is a sideshow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Joe, so you said, by and large, Iran is, you know, adhering to the deal. Yesterday, Tom Bossert kind of said, well, maybe they're paying their rent, but they're a bad tenant. Pompeo made some comparison to a couch. I didn't know what that was about. But but essentially that it doesn't matter if Iran is dealing with it, is adhering to the deal now.
Yeah.
It's about the intentions. You know, recently some German intelligence reports pointed to illicit procurement by the Iranians. David Albright, who we all know from ISIS, I won't say ISIS, says that Iran continues to produce advanced centrifuges, is stonewalling inspectors on access, and has occasionally, briefly, although they've, you know, walked it, they've come back and rectified that, exceeded their HU capacity. So even though they're adhering to the deal now, it seems as if they're skirting the line with the intent of, once the deal expires, to go at it again.
No. No. I don't think that's happening at all. The evidence of so-called violations that John Bolton and others are trying
to make. Well, David Albright is not a partisan, really.
It's true.
I would say that there's a group of people, a very small group of people in Washington who hated this deal, who didn't want this deal, and they're trying to raise objections to try and kill the deal. So let me just put you, without talking about the characterizing them any further, let me just tell you what the dust they're throwing up here, what we're talking about here. One of these supposed violations, and I take John Bolton because he did a big op-ed, and there were 4 senators led by Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz who wrote a letter to the president about this, just 4. And one of the things they cite is the heavy water. So heavy water is regular water that has a higher percentage of deuterium, an isotope of hydrogen that has a neutron with it. So it's twice as heavy as a regular isotope of hydrogen, which doesn't have a neutron. You use this as a moderator in reactors. It slows down the neutron so you can get the right fissile reaction. I'll tell you more about this if you want. But,
please don't.
But it's used for the plutonium production reactor. And so they were making water to be a moderator for the plutonium production reactor. There is no plutonium production reactor now. It doesn't exist. So this is like a secondary issue. It's like suspenders when you're wearing a belt. And what happened is in their production of this, they went a little over the limit. They're limited to, I think, 130 tons, and maybe they went like 10 tons over before they could ship it out of the country and put it someplace else. So this thing actually doesn't matter in any real proliferation, any real risk assessment. Same with the so-called advanced centrifuges. They're allowed to have 10 operating. Well, actually, the term is roughly 10. So is that 11? Is that 12? That's what the advanced centrifuge dispute is about. I mean, you're really kidding me, folks, if this is what you're calling a violation, when they dismantled the vast majority of the nuclear structure that we worried about. Remember that bomb that Benjamin Netanyahu had up on the UN podium, probably the famous, most famous cartoon in national security debates, where he warned the Iranians were coming here? Well, guess what? This deal drained the bomb. There is no potential for Iran to leap out and build a bomb anytime soon. And if they did, we would see them and could take action. That's the reality of the deal. Iran is adhering to the deal. The violation discussion is a smokescreen.
Okay, Tony, Joe calls it a smokescreen, but the question, I think, really, as opposed to like the technical elements of it, is that does Iran still have the intentions that you believe that they had and ambitions for a nuclear weapon that when the deal expires, they will go there again? I think that's where the Trump administration is trying to move this discussion.
Well, first, Joe's 100% right.
And thank
these
you.
These various complaints are like complaining about suspenders when you're wearing no pants. The fact of the matter is, across the line, everything that you laid out, these are very minute things. There's also a mechanism within the agreement. When you have a dispute, a disagreement...
You're listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled A Deal is a Deal, Examining the Iran Nuclear Deal. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this one with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
But a few things that are worth reminding. Even though there are sunset provisions in the agreement that remove some of the constraints, Iran is prohibited under the Non-Proliferation Treaty from ever getting a nuclear weapon. That's permanent. It is not allowed to do weapons-related research. That is permanent. There will be permanent inspections under the additional protocol. Again, all of that well beyond the 15, 20, or 25 years that the constraints will be in place. The other thing is this. When those constraints start to go away, not only will we be in no worse a place than we were when we signed the deal, we'll be in a much better place. We will have bought 15 or 20 or 25 years, we will have gained incredible knowledge about the people, the places, the technology, the entire supply chain that we didn't have because of this remarkably intrusive monitoring and inspection system. We will have used the time, I hope, to perfect our own responses, if they're ever needed, to disrupt Iran marching again toward a nuclear weapon. So every ability that an American president had before we had this deal, he or she will have it multiple times over to deal with an Iran that seeks to break out. There's one other point I think that's worth making, and maybe Alex can address this. One of the things that's always fascinated me about the discussion about Iran is that when you hear folks in our country talk about it, sometimes you get the impression that we believe it's the only country on earth that doesn't have politics, when in fact it has among the most intense politics of any country I know. When we were putting the deal together, we tried to focus on what it was, a deal to deal with a specific problem, which was the potential of Iran racing toward a nuclear weapon. Now, sometimes there are conversations about other impacts, effects the deal could have in our relationship with Iran, but that's not why we did it. But here's what's fascinating. If you read the Iranian press, if you listen to the debate in the Majlis, all of this incredibly open, the people who are most opposed to the deal in Iran are opposed to it, I believe, and Alex can tell me if this is wrong, because they see it as a Trojan horse into Iran. They see it as a first step in that starts to open up Iran to the international community and takes away the entire rationale for the revolution. That's why they see it as a mortal threat. That's why conservatives in Iran have been throwing wrenches into the works over the last 2 years. It's a very interesting thing to reflect on.
Alex, why don't you pick up on that? However, is withdrawing from the deal kind of giving the hardliners what they're looking for, which is, you know, is there a chance that the U.S. could go overboard on this?
First, I have to say I agree with everything that was said in terms of there was a lack of alternative. I mean, Joe and Tony laid out the context here. And we, to this day, we talk about, you know, let's kill the deal, and then what? And I think we're going to go back to where we were.
We're going to get to the then what.
But no, in terms of Tony's point about Iranian politics and the hardliners, as I said earlier, I don't see anybody in Iran seriously trying to make the argument, or at least a serious figure in Iran making the argument that they should unilaterally walk away from the deal. Though nobody in Iran says that. What they would love to see is for the United States to unilaterally walk away from the deal, because then they're going to stand up and say to the rest of the world, we abided by it, and the Americans are the ones who are not acting in good faith. But one thing I have to say, and I don't want to be spoiling the
spoil
movie.
Away.
Spoil away. But look, the Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei just turned 78. Mm-hmm. And as I tried to allude earlier, there will be a very nasty succession process going on. And it's anybody's guess in terms of who will succeed Khamenei. Now, I can tell you the people who are running Iran's ballistic missile program and mostly Iran's nuclear program, the guards, the generals in the Revolutionary Guards, would love to have somebody who's close to them be that next Iranian supreme leader. They had somebody in mind, Ebrahim Raisi, who ran on 19th of May, and he was trashed at the ballot boxes. But that doesn't mean the Revolutionary Guards are going to give up. In other words, the wild card here is, should Khamenei suddenly die, what would happen, and would the domestic calculations of the hardliners Iran be that politically for them, from domestic point of view, it makes sense for them to walk away from the deal? I don't want to make too much references to history, but 1979 and hostage crisis, the hardliners in Iran that took those American diplomats hostage did it primarily for domestic political reasons. They wanted to sideline their domestic opponents.
So what you're trying to say, I think, and I think others have said this too, is maybe the Trump administration is trying to push the Iranians without, and I want to ask you about this, pushing the Iranians to walk away.
No, I think that seems to be, at least that's how the Iranians look at it,
right.
And Jawad Zarif plainly said that.
Right. Corey, so President Trump had said it was a terrible deal, repudiated it, then grudgingly twice confirmed that Iran is in compliance, but then accused Iran of violating the spirit of the deal and stirring up other trouble, slapped new economic sanctions on the IRGC to punish them in new ways not covered by the deal. Is this either a cover to stay in the deal while keeping up the rhetoric on Iran, or is this a effort by the Trump administration to focus on other areas outside of the nuclear realm, or both?
So there may be some in the Trump administration who, as Alex suggests, would be enthusiastic about precipitating the Iranians walking away from the deal. But there are plenty of good reasons for the Trump administration to do what it's doing. And in fact, that as you said, Elise, they have twice validated that Iran is in compliance with the nuclear deal. I don't know what complying with the spirit of the agreement means.
Well, what they say is,
I'm not a lawyer, but I wouldn't want to go to court on that basis.
They say the spirit is, it was meant to create peace and security in the region. I don't think that's what the deal was about, really. It was about a limited nuclear issue.
I think spirit of the deal stuff is not anything I'd ever want to go to court with, right? Like, it's too squishy. But what we know what the Iranians are doing. They have increased by 60% since the deal went into force. Harassment, provocative behavior towards American naval vessels in international waters in the Straits of Hormuz. The last time that it happened, the Navy had to fire flares because the Iranians wouldn't respond to radio signals. And Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted out, "What is the American Navy doing in the Persian Gulf?" Right? So it's not, you shouldn't think about the assertiveness, the aggressiveness that the Iranians have taken to trying to use our concerns about sustaining the deal. We should not take that as Iran somehow magically not trying to capitalize on what's going on outside of the deal. The State Department's Sponsors of Terror report that came out last week once again lists Iran as the foremost state sponsor of terror in the world. They are actively trying to destabilize regional governments. They are, along with the Russians, keeping Bashar al-Assad in power in Syria and are party to the war crimes that government is committing. The Iranians are behaving exorbitantly badly. And what I think the Trump administration is doing exactly right is saying we will abide by the terms of the nuclear deal ourselves, but that does not mean we need to cede Iran regional hegemony and we need to be complicit in Iran taking advantage of our desire for a non-nuclear Iran to prevent us from having Iran behave badly in all sorts of other ways, taking hostages, a foreign national, all that bad stuff. The Trump administration's right to push back on that, and we shouldn't be so afraid that the deal will fall apart that we won't do what is legitimate outside the bounds.
And Corey's 100% right about that, and indeed, it was very clear throughout the negotiations that if we arrived at a deal, that didn't give Iran a pass on all of the activities that Corey just went through. To the contrary. And even during the interim deal and the final deal, we continued to vigorously apply sanctions against Iran for many of these activities. Here's the challenge. The art of the no deal for those who oppose it in Iran or in the United States is to provoke the other side into abrogating it.
Yeah.
That's the trick. So that's one thing to watch for. But on the other hand, as Corey said very rightly, there are many activities across the board that are profoundly objectionable on the part of Iran, and we have to stand up against them. Finding the right balance, calibrating this so that the deal doesn't also go tilt in the process, is very, very challenging. And it's all the more challenging at a point in time where we really don't have any communications to speak of with Iran. When we were negotiating the deal, of course, we were in constant communication with Iran, or at least with one segment of the Iranian bureaucracy. After the deal was struck, there was an ongoing channel between Secretary of State Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif. And indeed, what many of you will remember, we had an incident when the Iranians seized American sailors who had gotten out of their normal lane. That was resolved within 24 hours because Kerry was able to immediately contact Zarif, and they worked through the problem. I do worry that as this gets not less complicated but more complicated, as we resolve the Daesh situation in Iraq, we're going to then have potentially American forces, if they stay behind, and Iranian forces or Iranian-backed militia coming into contact. And that's grounds for potential conflict across the board. I know you may want to go through
this. No, I understand, but I mean, I want to push back a little bit on that because, yes, it's true there was an ongoing channel between Kerry and Zarif. Mm-hmm. Those soldiers were, sailors were released. And I know that this was not the point of the deal, mm-hmm. but there was a hope that the building of that foundation, the building of that channel, would be used to help cooperate against ISIS, against Syria.
Yes.
That really never happened. There was a lot of lip service paid to that they were talking about it, but whilst Kerry and Zarif were talking, there was never any kind of, I would say, larger regional benefit.
No, that's absolutely right. But having that channel at least gives you something if you wind up in an unintended face-off or conflict to try to defuse it. So I do worry that we don't have that. And then again, across the board, right now, there are areas where we could be in conflict with Iran, whether it's Iraq, whether it's in Syria, of course, again, as Daesh is defeated, all of these forces are rushing for control of Syria, including a lot of Iranian forces that are in Syria, in Yemen, of course. So having those kind of channels, mm-hmm. if only to defuse mm-hmm. Conflict or crisis, is really, really important.
So I want to go now to what happens if the deal tanks. We're looking ahead towards a certification in October. The administration has made quite clear that these next 90 days, as the Iran review progresses, that this will, I feel like it's all going to be kind of lumped together in terms of recertifying based on some of these other things that we're talking about. Alex, do you think that if the U.S. were to pull out of the deal, or to not recertify that Iran is meeting its commitments, does retaliation just come, does it come in the form of restarting the nuclear program? Or does retaliation take other forms in the region against U.S. personnel, against other targets of the United States, continuing and in fact kind of increasing its aggression in the region?
You know, it might be important to take a step back and remind ourselves that since 1979, certainly since the fall of Saddam Hussein, Iran has been the only country that openly declares the United States to be its enemy and wants the United States out of the region, which is one of, at the heart of the so much of the troubles between the U.S. and the Iranians. And I don't see Khamenei really changing his mind on that time, on that issue anytime soon. But going back to the issue of what happens if the deal tanks, again, as we mentioned, depends on who walks away. As I said, I do not see the Iranians wanting to walk away from this deal.
Let's say the U.S. walks away.
The U.S. walks away. The Iranians are not going to do anything to their nuclear program because they want the Europeans on their side. They are desperate for foreign investment. Iran needs to create about 750,000 jobs a year. They're making about a third of that. And these are people who live in the region. Arab Spring just happened around them. They know that they might think that they're invisible, but so did Hosni Mubarak and others. And look what happened to them. So they need foreign investment. They're desperate for foreign investment. Rouhani talks about $50 billion a year in foreign investment for the world's largest energy market in terms of oil and gas. They need huge amounts of foreign investment. They have gotten $5 billion, and that came from the French. So I think, you know, again, so much comes down to who wins, because one of the things for us to remember and recognize as a critical factor is the Iranian factions don't oftentimes operate based on national interest, but narrow factional interest. So it might be in the interest of the hardline.
That never happens here.
Well, yeah, we can argue that happens elsewhere. So the Revolutionary Guards right now, for instance, are trying to stop the coming in of foreign investment, not because necessarily foreign investment is seen to be bad in terms of creating jobs and so on, but because they think foreign investment is coming in, that will make Rouhani the political winner, and they don't want to see that because they want to make sure Rouhani doesn't, for example, become the next Iranian supreme leader, a position that he is clearly eyeing for himself.
Joe, you were going to talk about what happens. Let's say the U.S. pulls out of the deal and Iran does restart at the rate that it was before. Talk to us about what we're looking at in terms of Iranian breakout if in October the deal is over and Iran feels it has free rein.
I think Alex presents the optimistic scenario that we leave the deal and Iran pretty much keeps going along with the deal. I don't think that's likely at all. Frankly, I think they can mean if we walk away, we're going to take the blame for it. None of our allies are going to back us. As they told us, if we walk away from this deal, we walk away alone. So they will continue their involvement with the Iranians for their own strategic reasons. Iran would be hard-pressed not to reopen its nuclear program because of the political factors inside. And if they wanted to, what they could quickly do, well, one, the inspectors would be gone right away, so we'd lose a big part of our eyes and ears on what's going on in the Iran program. Second, they just start putting the centrifuges back. The two-thirds they ripped out, they go put them back in. And in a couple of years, you could be looking at Iran with not 5,000 centrifuges, but 20, 30,000 centrifuges. Not 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium, but 3,000, 6,000 kilograms. You could be looking at Iran within 2-3 years of being...
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled A Deal is a Deal, Examining the Iran Nuclear Deal. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive. We can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online now at aspenpublicradio.org.
The increased risk of a new war in the Middle East. All the arrows I see are pointing towards a new war. I see some people in the administration who want a war with Iran. Some of the people who didn't want a deal with Iran didn't want to make any deal with Iran because they didn't want to validate this, what they consider illegitimate regime. They're in favor of regime praise. This is.
You're saying we have another North Korea on our hands.
I think we have another Iraq war on our hands, except much bigger, much worse, much more expensive, and much more catastrophic. And it's not just because there's a small group that actually want to do this. There's a larger group, more of the adults in the room, who don't want to go to war but have no problem brushing back Iran, want to deliver a military blow that they think will teach Iran to get back in its corner. Plus, you have the chaos in the region that is growing, relatively independent of our actions, that was triggered by the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. So you have all these tensions in the region growing. You kill the deal, that's going to accelerate these tensions. And it's going to, what Tony said, we are getting real close to a conflict with Iranian forces, maybe not by choice, maybe not by any government choice, but by facts on the ground. We are cheek and jowl with Iranian forces in Syria, in Iraq, even in Yemen, as they say, a grenade's throw away. And as we beat Iraq, there, ISIS in Iraq and in Syria, there is going to be a race for that territory. And this is prime conflict
scenarios. That's why you've seen this week, if you've been looking, so many articles pop up about the increased risk of war. Take a look at the op-ed page of the New York Times for Wednesday, for example.
Corey. So I find persuasive Alex's conjecture that the Iranian government of almost whatever type will be so interested in sustaining the European financial connections.
And getting the Russians and Chinese on board and isolating the U.S., right?
That they will not overtly restart their nuclear program. But I do believe they have every incentive in the world to covertly restart it for exactly the reason you suggested, Elise, which is separating the United States from the other enforcers of the sanctions, so that what they would like to see is the United States stomping and hissing, they're in violation, and everybody else saying, no, that's not happening. That maximally isolates the United States. I think that's likely to happen. The second thing that I think is likely to happen is limited strikes by the United States on what we believe are suspect facilities that they would restart. I think you could also see limited strikes by a combination of Saudis and Israelis and the UAE,
really?
Who are also driven into very close cooperation by this. So that in some ways, what we saw in reaction to chemical weapons use in Syria, a limited strike that's not solving every problem, but is laying down a deterrent marker that we see what is happening and we will preserve an important norm to us. I think that's what is likely to happen. But what I am less sure on the third piece of it is what that will mean for the region, whether it will continue the divergence that you have seen between Qatar, Turkey, on one side, Egypt, Saudi, and others on the other side, in how they come down on this, Turkey and Qatar supporting Iran. And the others against it. I think that's also quite likely.
And you don't think Iran will strike back if we strike at them?
Yes, I do. And yet, what you are acting as though Iran has all of the leverage in these circumstances and we need to be terrified of using our leverage. And I actually think we have a much stronger hand than Iran does in the region, and we ought not to be deterred from doing what is in our interest, which is preventing Iran from crossing the nuclear threshold.
Tony.
Two quick points. Given how fraught and complicated this is, isn't it a good thing that Iran doesn't now have a nuclear weapon to make it even more complicated?
Well,
I think
said,
one
Tony.
Of the primary benefits of the deal is for all of the complications we have with Iran, that's at least one thing for now that we don't have to worry about. Second, even if we take the optimistic scenario, Alex's optimistic scenario with Corey's tweak to it, which I probably would fall down on that side of things, what happens then? You have a situation where the United States is not going with the deal. The Europeans are. That poses a real dilemma for us because we have to then say to ourselves, what are we going to do about the Europeans, never mind the Russians and Chinese? We may be tempted to start to impose secondary sanctions to prevent the Europeans from continuing to do business with Iran. Well, we've seen this movie before. We tried this in 1996. We were trying to stop investment in the Iranian energy sector. We imposed, put on the books secondary sanctions. The Europeans, no pun intended, went ballistic, took us to the WTO, threatened retaliation on trade, and finally all of this more or less went away and was put in abeyance. The last place we want to be is in a conflict with our own allies. The United States will be isolated, not Iran.
Joe, let's talk about if there is a way, President Trump said, I'll renegotiate the deal. Is there a way to renegotiate or, do amendments to the deal, prepare for the day when the deal expires, and supplement this and build on it as opposed to just pulling out? I know the Iranians don't want to talk about that right now, but feasibly, given the fact that this is a multilateral deal, what do you see as the possible scenarios?
You can't reopen this deal. You're not going to renegotiate this deal. That's not going to happen again. But you can supplement it. You can add to it. This is why Ambassador Turki Alfasl, the former Saudi ambassador to the United States, former Minister of Intelligence for Saudi Arabia, who opposed the deal while it was being negotiated, now says, keep it, build on it, use it as a stepping stone. So you can do that. You think that Iran shouldn't have that many centrifuges? You don't like the expiration of some of the limits in 15 years? Fine. Negotiate a supplementary agreement.
And what's the incentive for Iran to do that?
Because they want greater economic relief from the sanctions we have. They want to be what they thought the deal was going to give them, reintegration into the Western financial and economic markets. And we can do a lot more there. We've been holding back on that. In fact, with President Trump at the G20 actively discouraging trade with Iran, which, by the way, is a violation of the accord. So you can do a lot more. So the Iranians would like to get more. We would like more. There's even a phrase with this that people call it more for more. So you want to do this, there's a deal to be made. Maybe the great deal maker can actually show that he knows how to make a deal, and Donald Trump could negotiate something that could be to the benefit of regional peace and the parties, all the parties involved. This is the path forward.
Alex, do you think the Iranians would be open to that?
Look, I mean, the supreme leader of the land has issued a fatwa saying they don't want a nuclear weapon. So if he's going to stick to that, then I don't see why he wouldn't be willing to add to the agreement. And, for instance, I think, you know, going to medium enrichment happens. They can enrich to medium levels in 15 years' time.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Right, that sort of thing, I can see the Iranians being flexible around. But look, I mean, one of the things we ought to also remember here, to Corey's point about America having leverage, that's absolutely true. The United States has a leverage. The Iranians do very much fear the United States. They have always done since this revolution succeeded in 79. They only think there's one power in the world that can bring them down, and that is the United States. But frankly, the United States doesn't really have a coherent strategy on Iran, nor a narrative. I think, you know, when I look at what Iran is doing in the region, I'm almost, I want to separate the nuclear issue from what Iran is doing in terms of the region.
Yeah.
I mean, what Iran is doing in terms of training of thousands of Shia militiamen from Afghanistan, Pakistan, all the way to Kashmir, ship them over to Syria to fight basically sectarian war, there will be long-term ramifications for this, for the entire region, and most importantly for the Iranian reformists at home. Whenever the Revolutionary Guards wins outside in the region, when they can support Assad and keep him in place, the biggest loser of that are the Iranian reformist majority back home, because they will then have to deal with emboldened Revolutionary Guards. So I think we need to start thinking about what is America's narrative on the question of the Iranian threat. We cannot abandon we can abandon the Russians, the Chinese, not because of choice, but because of reality. But you should not forget the Europeans. The Europeans need to believe that the United States still has a convincing message in this post-JCPOA world. And I don't think the U.S. is trying hard. I mean, last week, Interpol held a counterterrorism conference in downtown Tehran. You know, Interpol is in Tehran having so you want to talk about the terrorism threat from Iran, and yet Interpol is having a workshop. I think we need to start thinking about the narrative and make sure we have allies on board.
Okay, we're going to open it up to questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand. Identify yourself. Keep your questions short so we can take as many questions as possible. And please make it an actual question. We'll go to this gentleman right here.
Hi. Lionel Beener with West Point. Question for Alex. A little bit more about the sort of Game of Thrones palace intrigue going on in Tehran. I mean, about 10 years ago, the Supreme Leader's health, he had a really bad health scare. And there was a talk about not potentially maybe not having a Supreme Leader or some kind of rotating panel of elders or something like that. I wonder if you could, like, conjecture what would happen. Do we necessarily have to keep this? I mean, what would happen in the event of his passing? Would there be a coup? Would there be the Guardian Council have more power internally? What would happen? Would it just be another Supreme Leader?
The short, and I'm afraid almost rude answer, is we don't know. Last time they had a succession process, and the only time they had a succession process, in summer of 1989, nobody knew. And the guy who claims he knew what happened just died in January. But that was the reason why Khamenei became the Supreme Leader. He did not have the qualifications. Nobody expected him to be on the shortlist. He ended up becoming the Supreme Leader and has now reigned for as long as he has.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled "A Deal is a Deal, Examining the Iran Nuclear Deal." This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive. We can only bring you live broadcasts like this one with your support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
What we do know is the Revolutionary Guards, if you want to sort of divide Iran into three centers of power, the main ones, the office of the Supreme Leader on the top, the Presidential Palace, Rouhani on one side, and the Revolutionary Guards on the other, The Revolutionary Guards are extremely fearful of what Rouhani and people around him want to do. They fear that what Rouhani wants to do, to Joe and Tony's point, I think, is to open Iran up quietly, and before they know it, they're gone. They're forced to take their uniforms off. They're no longer going to have 40% of the Iranian economy under their control. That is everything they have stood for. Someone like Qasem Soleimani, who was a 14-year-old bricklayer back in Kerman province in 1979, joined the Iran-Iraq war, rose through the ranks over the last couple of decades, and is the man he is today. He looks at the future and says, if Rouhani gets his way, if I have to abide by all the rules of the international community, I'm out of a job. Mm-hmm. And that's what those guys are motivated by, preventing that scenario from happening.
Any other questions? Right here.
See, and that's why our strategy should be greater engagement. We should have the U.S. corporations going into Iran, not being kept out.
Stuart Bernstein, former American ambassador to Denmark. What's the position of the Israelis now, or Netanyahu? And what you mentioned something about the Emirates, Israel, and Saudi Arabia working on something together?
Corey, virtually, one quick word on this, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What's fascinating from the Israeli perspective is if you ask virtually any senior member, past or present, of the intelligence services and the military, they all support the deal. Some of them say it publicly.
Yeah.
All of them say it privately. It's taken away one problem, or at least pushed it far into the future. Now, there are divisions on the political side of the house in Israel, but even Prime Minister Netanyahu is inveighing with much less force and much less frequency against the deal. This is, I think, at least really started us out. This is now a given. Yeah. So despite some efforts in both countries to look for ways to undo it, I think in the region, there is a general acceptance that this is the reality they're dealing with, and what we don't need, what no one needs right now, is throwing another grenade in the mix that's going to make things even more complicated than they already are.
I just met with the former head of Shin Bet, Carmi Gidlon, in Washington. He wrote an article where he calls the Iran deal a blessing for Israel because it eliminated, at least for the next 15 years, this existential threat from Iran. They do have other problems, but these things they feel the IDF can handle. We can handle the rest of the problems. It was the nuclear problem that this deal solved for them.
Corey.
So I agree with Tony that taking the nuclear issue, putting the nuclear issue in a box for 10 years, even though countries in the region opposed it when the deal was being made and believed a much better deal should have been made, they now consider it stabilizing and beneficial. One of the things that has been most interesting in Middle East politics in the last 10 years is watching the countries of the Gulf in particular, who had long excoriated the state of Israel and refused to even have mutually constructive dealings with the state of Israel, seeing that the rise of Iran as a regional threat has actually given them common cause. And I think we have gone from a place where in maybe 2005 or 6, the Saudis would have said, as some Saudis said to me, that if Israel was going to strike the Iranian nuclear program, Saudi would just turn their radars off and pretend they didn't see Israel crossing their territory, to a place where now, in part because they worried about abandonment from the Obama administration, diplomatically, you see a lot more cooperation, particularly between the countries of the Gulf, Jordan, and Israel. And I think that includes some intelligence and military cooperation.
There's actually a story today in Haaretz about how the foreign minister of the UAE and Netanyahu had the secret meeting in New York, that speaks to that point, Alex. I know you had a...
I was actually really surprised that when President Trump went to the Middle East a month or so ago, my expectation of the deal I anticipated he would be trying to make would have been to get the Arab countries that were all gathered in Saudi to agree to the recognition of Israel and in return deliver a Palestinian-Israeli peace deal.
I think we could all agree that would be the ultimate deal. You had a quick point.
Quick point on Israel. I think, you know, when Foreign Minister Zarif was in the U.S., he made the point that, which he always makes, that, you know, Iran is a force for good and you, in the region. You cannot deny the fact that Iran is a critical player in the Middle East, the country of 80 million with its fingers in so many different places. Absolutely can be ignored, and I think it would be foolish for us to think we can. But how do we engage it? How do we get others around the world to come to the American point of view to sort of put more pressure on the Iranians while leaving the nuclear track alone and not spoil anything there? The Israel question is one of the things I think the Europeans certainly could do a lot about when they're looking for investment opportunities. You know, I can tell you this, at least, that the Iranian Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, is not known to be a man who sort of engages in knee-jerk reaction that often. He thinks about things. He suddenly came out and said recently twice, you know, there should be a jihad in Kashmir. And you sort of sit there and scratch your head and said, why is he suddenly talking about jihad in Kashmir for? Well, he was very upset that the Indian prime minister had visited Israel. And he's been upset in the past when the Chinese are dealing with the Israelis. In other words, the Iranians know their position in Israel is untenable. Israel's part of life in the region, and they ought to start changing their tune. And that is, I think, a point we can, you know, tell someone like Zarif, who might be able to go and successfully tell the more hardliners, look, we need to start thinking about less revolutionary state, more of a mainstream state for the benefit of Iran and everybody in the region.
There's a gentleman in the back in a blue shirt, and I'm going to take one more question. Is Ambassador Wittig here?
There's a question over there as well.
Hello?
And this woman in the blue. So we'll take that man in the blue shirt, in the beard first, and then this woman in the blue.
Hi, I'm Marty Sherwin, George Mason University. Are there any lessons from the Iran deal applicable to the North Korean situation?
That's great, a great question.
Great question. And ma'am?
You're going to have to come back tomorrow afternoon.
Let's set the stage for that.
I'm sorry.
All right. And then jumping off of that, also have a question about the relationship and exchange of scientists between Iran and North Korea. In particular, many have been reported over the past few years in what is the status?
Those are great questions, and the director, Director Pompeo, kind of alluded to that yesterday. Joe, you want to?
Just the lessons are there's no military solution to this, and all our former secretaries of defense have agreed with that, and that's how the Joint Chiefs of Staff feel about this. Maybe it makes you feel good to launch a strike against one of these nuclear facilities, but that's just going to redouble the opponent's efforts. It's not going to solve your problem. Everybody said that too. There's no way to sanction a country into collapse or compliance. Forget it. Sanctions alone are never going to work. They're just a tool to do what? Get them to the negotiating table. And that's the answer. You want to fix this? No country has ever been coerced into collapse or compliance over nuclear issues, but lots of countries have been convinced to make a deal. And you can do that with Iran. We just did it. You can do that with North Korea. It's hard. It's difficult. There's no guarantees, but it is far easier than any of the other alternatives.
And the lesson that flows from that, too, is that if we want to have any chance at getting the North Koreans to the table to negotiate something, and as people have said earlier, probably at best a freeze on their testing, which would be a very good thing, because it would make it much more difficult for them to get to the point where they have a reliable ICBM with a nuclear weapon that can hit us. To get them to the table, the last thing that we want to do is abrogate the Iran nuclear deal, because what message does that send to North Korea? Already, as has been said, they look at Libya, they look at Iraq. We should be pointing to the Iran nuclear deal as evidence, as proof that you can negotiate, that you can get to a better place that meets the security interests of all parties.
Okay. Just one quick point. I think this notion of there being no military solution, which has come up twice this morning already, is a canard. Nobody's arguing that military force all by itself solves this problem, but limited uses of military force do affect risk calculations, and they can create a stronger basis for diplomacy and negotiation.
Alex,
that's the point.
Why don't you take the quick scientist point?
Very quickly on North Korea. I'm an open source guy, so I'm sure there's much more out there in the classified world than I know. But, you know, in the historical context, when the Iranian Revolution happened, obviously the United States stopped supplying the Iranian military. One of their strengths was their air force, but that was American-delivered, American-supplied air force. So they were kind of scrambling, figuring out where do we get some missiles from, and there the North Koreans came in. So the history between Iran and North Korea is long, going back to the early 80s.
I didn't hear the question.
It's focused on the military side, primarily, as far as I can tell, ballistic missiles. How deep it is, that's the question that I don't really have a good answer for, but it would be very interesting to find out.
All right, well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. I want to thank the panel very much for a lively discussion, and thank you. Thank you, everybody.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the 2017 Aspen Security Forum. You can also find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. It is our summer pledge drive, and live broadcasts like this one from the Aspen Security Forum are only possible with support from you, our listeners. Lots of news outlets cover things like Ideas Festival, Aspen Music Festival, and school performances in the Aspen Security Forum, but here on Aspen Public Radio, you can listen to sessions like this firsthand. We ask you to call in your pledge now so we can continue to bring you these type of live events, 920-9000, or go online to aspenpublicradio.org to pledge your support. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale, your news, your music, your station.
Have the authority to look into any possible financial links between President Trump's campaign and Russia. NPR's Greg Myrie reports this comes as the